In the coming week, President Lula reckons with Brazil's Capitol riots. Prime Minister Kishida Fumio meets President Biden in Washington. And the Czech Republic holds presidential elections. It's January 12, 2023, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon, and filling in for Jim Lindsay today is Sheila Smith. She is the John E. Merrow Senior Fellow for Asia-Pacific Studies at the Council. Sheila, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Bob. It's my pleasure. Bob, let's start in Brazil. This past Sunday, thousands of supporters for former President Jair Bolsonaro stormed the presidential palace, Congress, and Supreme Court. They were convinced that the recent elections were stolen. Sounds familiar. While security forces have quelled the rioters, how will President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva handle the aftermath of a clearly divided nation?
That is the question of the moment, Sheila. I think what's interesting to note initially is just the response. I think it was a bit personal, but also among all the kind of the Brazil watchers and experts and so forth, which was shocked that this happened, not surprised that this happened, because it had been playing out since the elections, before the elections even. Again, echoes of what happened in January 6th in the United States. Jair Bolsonaro saw the polls, saw himself dropping in the polls, still really close election, lost it though, by all accounts, free and fair elections. And then, you know, was not stepping forward to say, I congratulated my opponent and we're going to move on for the sake of Brazilian democracy. In fact, snubbed the formal ceremony in which you pass over the presidential sash, lands in Miami. Turns out he was, among other things, getting some medical treatment, but also conveniently out of the country. And lo and behold, you have a riot. Differences, though, Sheila, just to recap really quickly, are that Lula was already sworn in. He was already president. There wasn't a vote. There wasn't a Mike Pence in waiting in Brazil there to sort of authorize the vote totals and so forth. Lula was president, but also the rioters who were very much enforced on the levels we saw on January 6th overran three branches of government, not just Congress. It was Parliament. It was the Supreme Court. It was the presidential chambers as well. And great deal of damage done. There were personal injuries and a great deal of concern about just what this boded for Brazil. Brazil also a much younger democracy than the United States. Recent memories of many Brazilians of a military dictatorship are still there. And so the concern there was that this was going to open the door for the military to say, okay, well, we have to come in and assert control. This is enough is enough. These elections were shady. We've heard enough. Let's assert control. Jair Bolsonaro, strong military background, had brought a lot of military people into his administration. There were some assumptions by what we're reading that the military was going to, you know, allow some sort of a transitional interruption to happen or pave the way for something disturbing to happen. That didn't happen, though. You did have some concern and some actions by security forces in general at the scene that were not trying to quell the situation. At the same time, the military came in and started arresting people, started detaining people. By last count, something like 1,500 have been detained. So now you have a question where President Lula, who called them vandals and many other things, has to deal with a not insignificant amount of people who, one, contest his legitimacy, but also are willing to do violence to sort of challenge federal rule. He's got to deal with that in various ways. And so a big question is, how vigorously will he go after those who staged this and also look for the roots of any sort of plot? You know, it was, again, similar to January 6th in that it seemed, while there was some planning, it also seemed like a haphazard set of affairs where people just kind of rampage and there was a lot of venting of spleen, so to speak, but not really any concerted, like, you know, going to certain chambers, detaining people. In fact, there are very few people, if any, on the scene of any of these, at any of these buildings in Brasilia that could have been assaulted, detained, taken hostage, whatever. And so it's a question of how far Lula will go on that front. There's a really interesting piece out in Foreign Affairs about what Lula has to rely on, which is a really strong civil society in Brazil that gets overlooked a lot. They were the backbone of support for Lula's coming back into office, for one thing. They are the sort of grassroots democracy organizers, people who help, among other things, under COVID, where Brazil had a pretty awful response from the federal level. They helped sort of generate healthcare responses and generate aid to impoverished communities. That's just a couple of examples, and I definitely commend people to read this Foreign Affairs article because it really sheds light on the role of civil society in Brazil. So I think you'll see Lula resorting to that or relying on that part of his strength of his base. And then seeing whether, you know, Brazil can come through this okay. It got a lot of expressions of support from abroad. President Biden came out vigorously in support of Brazilian democracy. He's got an invitation to Lula to visit the U.S. in early, I believe it's early February. And so it's just the question of, you know, how deep does this go in Brazil and how concerning is it? Are there things still percolating that we don't know about?
And what happened to Bolsonaro?
So Bolsonaro himself made some statements condemning violence. Somewhat tepid in the greater scheme of things, given what's at stake in the country, and certainly did not come out with any sort of statements like we need to acknowledge Lula's leadership and so forth. Nothing of that nature, just sort of asserting his support for law and order in Brazil. And he's getting treatment. He's getting medical treatment, actually. He still has complications from a stabbing incident when he was running for president in 2018. And so he has that to deal with. There are questions of whether or not he needs to leave Florida relatively soon, whether or not it'll escalate to any sort of level of like extradition or anything like that. That's not clear. That is a question about how the Bolsonaro part of this is going to be dealt with, because the phrase we've heard is Bolsonarismo, which is his whole sort of way of governing, his whole set of values that his strong supporters very much hold to, whether that continues to hold a lot of strength and whether he, in his own expressions of support for the protesters, will somehow continue to feed this movement. It needs to be dealt with. So that's another really big issue. And we're seeing, you know, the tamping down of protests, the arrests, the restoration of calm, you know, is, well, helpful and helps people kind of come at ease a little bit, like we saw initially in Peru. It could also snap back into alarming actions, too. Brazil is a giant country, and we don't know the extent to which other areas of support for Bolsonaro are still out there. Again, he lost with like 1.8% of the vote or something like that back in October and had a lot of really strong support. So we'll see what happens. My reference to Peru was that Peru has snapped back into a really serious situation where there's been outbreaks of violence and something like 50 plus deaths so far on this week.
Wow, that's incredible. So the Bolsonaro tension with Lula will continue. We should expect it to continue. Well, I look forward to welcoming President Lula to Washington. So we'll look forward to seeing
that. Should be quite a visit. It really should. Among other things, he is already, even ahead of him taking office again, he's thrown himself into environmental activism and sort of safeguarding the Brazilian portion of the Amazon, which is the largest portion, and big involvement in climate change type things. A number of issues that very much resonate in the Biden administration, even though there probably were still going to be some differences coming to the fore. I think it will be some sort of an attempt at solidarity. But Sheila, I wanted to take us to another big visit coming up imminently, which is the visit of Japan's Prime Minister Kishida Fumio to Washington. This is supposed to be taking place tomorrow. We're taping this podcast on Thursday. And he's going to meet President Biden. They're going to discuss a whole range of U.S.-Japan cooperation on issues like climate change, North Korea, Ukraine, the Taiwan Strait. So a lot of security, a lot of existential climate discussions. What should we be focusing on this visit?
Well, Bob, this is a big visit for Prime Minister Kishida, and he has been on a diplomatic tour this week. He is going to host the next G7 meeting in May in his home region of Hiroshima. So this is a big moment for Japan to shine, but also for Prime Minister Kishida to shine on the global stage. I think there's two things to keep in mind here. Prime Minister Kishida came into office, of course, after Prime Minister Suga, who had succeeded Prime Minister Abe. So we are still in a moment of looking at Japanese politics and wondering, you know, is Mr. Kishida going to continue to be prime minister? And I think this year he's done an excellent job of navigating some difficult domestic politics, difficult tensions within the party that resulted after the tragic loss of Abe Shinzo, the former prime minister.
Who was assassinated.
He was assassinated in July last year, surprisingly, by somebody with a handcrafted gun. A very big shock, not only for the Japanese people, but for the world at large, and great outpouring of support for Japan and sympathy for the Abe family. But I think, you know, Kishida has had a difficult, bumpy ride since that assassination. The party politics have been difficult. There's been some investigation of the assailants' claims that the Unification Church has, you know, basically been acting in a predatory manner towards unfortunate people in Japan, like the assailant's mother, who gave all of the family wealth to the Unification Church. And that revelation has also released some pressures on the Kishida cabinet. Largely, the LDP is associated with many individual politicians, have claimed that they have Unification Church supporters in campaigning for them, and maybe they've given speeches at events. And so the public has really come down quite harshly on this, and Mr. Kishida's support rating has gone down to the 30 percentile. Not a very good place to be when you've got a large diplomatic and strategic agenda. So that large diplomatic strategic agenda, though, I think has been a great success for the prime minister. After Russia's invasion of Ukraine in last February, Japan came out very forcefully in support of the rules-based order, joined immediately the sanctioning through the G7, the sanctioning of Russia, and also the assistance and aid to Ukraine. Your listeners probably won't remember this, but back in 2014, when Russia illegally annexed Crimea, Japan had a very muted response because then Prime Minister Abe was trying to negotiate with Vladimir Putin over a peace treaty and an island territorial dispute in the northern part of
Japan.
There
was a lot of muted responses going around back then. Yes.
Back then, right. Yeah. This is very different. This is a very, just so you also know that Mr. Kishida was foreign minister at the time. So he had that experience personally of being the representative to the G7 at the time. But he came out very quickly this time to condemn the Russian behavior, despite the consequence for Russia-Japan relations. And I think that the Japanese, both the sanctioning response and the assistance to Ukraine and its surrounding countries who are taking in refugees, has been really remarkable. Japan just announced a pretty substantial package of assistance of generators and other kinds of aid for the Ukrainian people during this tough winter period that they're having to go through. But I think the G7 has also been a forum for Kishida to really lay out that he believes that the Russian invasion of Ukraine is not a European problem, not just talking about a specific region of the world, but rather speaks to a larger challenge to the global rules-based order that Japan has successfully navigated for the last 70-some years. So he has been a great advocate for Indo-Pacific European collaboration. You'll see that in his visit to Italy, France, and the UK, that very prominent endorsements of continued collaboration, not only on Ukraine, but on global security and other kinds of issues. In London, he's just been in London, he signed a defense pact with the UK that will allow British and Japanese forces to visit each other's countries and operate freely from each other's countries, which, as you know, Japan hasn't really been all that willing to do outside its own region and outside its own borders. So pretty significant shift for Japan in terms of its global engagement. He's also worried about nuclear risk. And again, coming from Hiroshima and being Japanese, that's
Japan has always been in the forefront of non-proliferation efforts, right?
Exactly. So be it through the United Nations or, you know, just in its bilateral relations with the nuclear powers, Japan has always had a focus on this issue of nuclear risk and nuclear disarmament. So expect that to be part of the G7 agenda in May. But there's another area where I think Prime Minister Kishida has been very successful, and that is he initiated a strategic review a year ago. And basically, his party, the Conservative Party, and the government began to consider how to upgrade Japanese defenses to meet the shifting military balance in Northeast Asia. Japan has not had a really massive increase in military power ever in its past. It's always taken the step-by-step, slow-by-slow, incremental approach to its military's capabilities. But Kishida has embraced a new ambition to raise Japanese security spending to 2% of GDP, which would align it with NATO ambitions as well. And he has approved a $317 billion spending plan for the next 5 years to kickstart that effort. That's huge in Japanese politics, and it happened with barely a murmur of opposition.
I was going to ask, you know, is there any backlash to any of this domestically?
Where you'd expect backlash, Bob, is from the opposition parties. Very quiet. You'd expect it also from the public. Some people are uneasy. You've got little bits of criticism about how he's going to do it. And I think the biggest political challenge for him is going to figure out how to finance it. Is it going to be taxes? Is it going to be debt financing? Is it going to be taking tax revenue from another place in the government budget and shifting it over to defense? I think it's going to be all of the above. But that's where the politics are likely to focus, is not on the goals, but on how to finance those goals, which again is pretty remarkable. The second thing is that and we could talk forever and I won't, I'll just give you one highlight, I think, on the defense plan that went with this. So it's a 10-year defense plan.
Okay.
Lots of detail that we could talk about, but the biggest, Japan is going to invest in long-range missiles that would allow it what we would call a conventional strike capability. So if there's something going on and a potential adversary is looking like it's going to encroach upon Japanese security, Japan will, for its own defenses, be able to use that capability.
So, and again, post-war Japan, this is new.
This is absolutely new. They've always kept capabilities firmly in the frame of defensive purposes only. You know, when the proliferation of missiles in North Korea began in the mid-1990s, Japan invested in ballistic missile defense systems, not retaliatory capability. So this is a shift. And of course, the adversaries or the potential adversaries that Japan sees in its neighborhood, of course, are North Korea with all its missiles and changing technological capabilities for those
and
missiles.
Testing missiles
testing
over
missiles
Japan
all the
Japanese
time.
Airspace.
Right. Japanese airspace, having them come down in Japanese EEZs and, you know, and of course, the rise of Chinese military capability has been, I think, the biggest shock, I think, to the Japanese defense planners. It is comprehensive, as you know, technologically sophisticated, cross-domain capabilities that make it difficult maybe for the United States to come to Japan's assistance.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously challenge not just Japan, but the alliance also. So this is big. So counterstrike, I think, is one of the big highlights of this defense plan, but there's a whole host of them. You could have a podcast on this alone, frankly.
Yeah.
So I won't go into the detail, but that's he's bringing this to Washington. And just yesterday, we had a meeting here, what's called a 2+2 strategic dialogue between the United States and Japan. So that's our secretaries of defense and state with the Japanese ministers of defense and foreign affairs. And they announced that they have force posture adjustments for the alliance. So we're going to get a new organization of Marines in the southwestern islands in Japan, a very important place where the Chinese are operating. You got new statements of Article 5 protections for Japan that are obviously in the disputed island of what the Japanese refer to as the Senkakus, but also in space, other domains as well where the Article 5 protections were articulated. So what you're going to see going forward now, I think, is a U.S.-Japan conversation on how do we integrate our planning? How do we think about operational coordination in case of a crisis or worst case scenario, war? And this is where the Japanese now are going to have a permanent joint command to operate their self-defense forces, which will be the touchstone for our forces from Hawaii. So it's a big shift. It's a big upgrade. And it's a pretty significant agenda ahead of us now for the U.S.-Japan alliance.
So Sheila, there's multiple places we could talk. As you say, we could do a whole podcast on this alone. But one I just want to follow up on is the question of Taiwan. What should we know or what should we be looking for as it involves the U.S.-Japanese coordination related to Taiwan Strait tensions?
So this is going to be homework, I think, that has many dimensions for the U.S. and Japan. The United States has 54,000 military personnel on Japanese territory. We have an aircraft carrier task force home ported in Yokosuka. So it's not as if we are going to go to Japan. We are embedded, so to speak, bases in Japan and operate across the spectrum of issues, air, surface, you know, submarine kind of operations we practice and exercise together all the time. So there's been a lot going on as the PLA has upped its pressure on Taiwan, its military pressures on Taiwan. We've been doing an awful lot with the Japanese to make sure that we're ready and we're watching and we're sharing our intelligence together. What's ahead are some of the questions that are going to be on the table is, as I alluded earlier, is the command issue. How would the U.S. and Japanese forces act even pre-use of force in a crisis where you have a very sensitive and escalating dynamic, perhaps? How would we operate across domains is the military language, but that means in space, in cyber, and again, maritime areas together. How do we think about the political dimension? So the prime minister and the president, how are we going to think about when and if we use force together and under what circumstances? I think for the Japanese people and the Japanese prime minister, the primary goal of the self-defense forces is the defense of Japan. So they will be locating a potential Taiwan scenario within that broader planning of making sure that Japan is covered. And as you know, if you imagine a map of Japan, of course, their northern border is Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Their sort of western side is the Korean Peninsula. And then down to the southwest, you have where the Chinese PLA has been operating quite frequently, and that's where Taiwan is. So this 2+2 statement highlights those southwestern islands. And the Marine Corps is in the process of reorganizing its forces across the Pacific to make them more mobile and ready. And they announced that there will be a new Marine Littoral Regiment now stationed in Okinawa that will be of assistance to Japan, obviously, but would obviously have a critical role in case of a Taiwan contingency. So I think what we're going to see is an exploration of the political dimensions of a crisis, how to manage it. There's an alliance coordination mechanism that has been created in the alliance, and that will be the focal point for thinking through some of these questions. But I think you're also going to see a broader address. You know, Mr. Kishida will talk to President Biden about what he sees as the next piece of planning that his government is going to undertake. And I think the Taiwan scenario and the cross straits, the potential for cross straits tensions will be high on that list.
Great. And I'll note for our listeners, we have a feature on our website that you've worked on, Sheila, and continue to work on, which is tracking Japan's constitutional changes and sort of how they've come about this shift in thinking and in posture and defense, especially.
Yeah, no, I definitely take a look at that. The Constitution has never been amended. And I think some people think that because of Article 9, you have to change Article 9 to have military policy change. And that's actually not true. But I think it's an important reference point to think about how the Japanese people are also thinking about their military. Bob, let's continue this focus that we began on democracy. This weekend, the Czech Republic will choose a new president. After a decade with President Miloš Zeman, polls indicate that the top three candidates will tie in the first round of voting, and it looks like we'll go to a second round after that. Why is the Czech election so significant for Europe?
Well, first, let me just spell out the role of the president. Like in a lot of other countries, it's not as much power as resides in the prime minister and in parliament to make laws and so forth and direction of the country. However, president in the Czech Republic under the constitution has the power to pick the prime minister, to appoint members of the central bank board, to select constitutional court judges with the approval of the parliament's upper house. And as in many countries, there is a moral authority there. Let's not forget the first president of the post-communist Czech Republic was Václav Havel, a figure of huge authority who basically willed the country into NATO and EU ahead of its time in some ways, especially NATO, where it just wasn't ready militarily, but it was seen as crucial for that country to join NATO. And I think the country has it's faced some pushback domestically on that, but in general, I think it holds a sort of a proud place in NATO. And Prague Castle has its mythical role, too. It is literally a castle. It sits atop a hill overlooking Prague, breathtaking view. And it's so when you refer to Prague Castle, you're talking about, in some ways, the symbol of the country. And so it's an important position to have. In some ways, many would say Zeman degraded that role in terms of some of his, you know, petty squabbles he got in, his initial strong support for keeping warm ties with Russia, reaching out to China and so forth. I will note he turned against Russia after the Ukraine invasion and the brutality of that invasion. But he's been seen as sort of not the kind of figure in the stature of a figure the country should have at this point, as kind of an old guard figure. So they have a very clear choice. Czechs have a very clear choice in the three candidates you mentioned that are running neck and neck. There, one is basically full-fledged populist, Andrej Babiš. He's a former prime minister. He leads the ANO party. And he recently was cleared of fraud charges that had dogged him for years, that he had abused EU funds for some of his own personal holdings. But he does definitely court the populist, you know, sort of a nativist note in the country, has spoken out against the embrace or the inclusion of so many Ukrainian refugees. I believe there's something like 400,000 in the Czech Republic. And would be expected to maybe chart a different course as president in terms of his own statements about support for Ukraine. It's still up to the government to maintain the support it has had, and it has been strong. So there's Andrej Babiš, there's Petr Pavel, who was actually an army general affiliated with NATO, and he very much strongly supports the kind of integration, Czech's integration with the West in so many ways and institutions, and whether it's NATO, EU, and so forth. Another candidate, a newcomer, is Danuše Nerudová, who would be the first woman president of the Czech Republic. And she is an economist, and she also has strong orientation towards the West. She's 44 years old, so has grown up really only knowing Czech Republic affiliated with Europe and Western institutions and so forth. And so very clear choices for Czech voters. The expectation is, given the divisions and given the fact that you need to have an outright majority in the first round, this will go to a second round, which would be in 2 weeks. And then it's a question of, you know, what is it? Is it between Pavel and Nerudova? Does Babiš make it to the second round? Babiš has a lot of tools at his disposal, including, you know, being able to get his message out on media in terms of he's got a kind of a core support that is strong, as populists will do. And so that's going to be very interesting to note. He's relatively late to this race as well. And so it's a question of how much support he really has, whether he can make it to that round. The assumption is if he does make it to the second round, he does not have enough support to beat either Pavel or Nerudova. In some ways, like Brazil, there is a civil society component to Czech politics, and that could rally around the Western-oriented candidate and spell the end for Babiš in his presidential run. But, you know, it's a dicey time still because Ukraine creates all sorts of passions. But I will say that with the exception of Hungary, you have had a very strong expression of support and solidarity for Ukrainians around Eastern Europe. Slovaks, certainly. And the Poles, who are having their own troubles with the EU over other issues, governance issues like the independence of their judiciary, but at the same time have welcomed many more refugees than the Czech Republic, in the millions, I believe, at this point, and have been strong supporters and are, you know, obviously sharing a big border with Ukraine. So the Poles are very much in solidarity with Ukraine. And I think you have that sentiment, certainly in the Baltic countries, where there are major figures in exile from places like Belarus set up, where you have very strong statements of rhetoric, as well as support per capita. Some of the strongest support for Ukraine is coming from the Baltic states. And then in varying degrees, as you get into southern and central, the rest of central Europe. So it's another one of these bellwether elections in some ways, an important symbolic role that we'll see filled, if not soon, probably in 2 weeks. And so it's a kind of a gut check for Europe and its support for Ukraine.
I think that those three candidates are pretty fascinating. And the idea that in this race, we have the first woman to run for the office of president is also exciting in lots of ways. There's a lot of younger women coming to the fore in Europe. Do you see this as being something that will really help Danuš as she appeals to Czech voters?
Yeah, that's going to be one of the areas to watch really closely. You know, is it a generational thing? Because Petr Pavel is, I believe, 60, 61 years old. Babiš is 68. You know, so she's 44. She's a woman, and she speaks the language of sort of Western democracy, liberal democracy, and so forth. So is that enough for the country? When I lived in the Czech Republic in the late 1990s, there was still while it was the country of Havel, it was still a country that had a pretty strong, you know, sort of bedrock of support for the communist era. And there was a communist party that would poll very successfully a core number of votes with every election. And there were people who were worried about the pace of change back then and the rush to join EU institutions because that meant changing their lifestyle. So whether or not that sentiment is enough to throw support behind a Babiš type candidate, it is not clear. The polling is very interesting. But again, since you have two candidates who have a number of common positions on, certainly on EU support, the thinking is that that's going to then prevail in a second round. And then it becomes, is this country going to join the ranks of countries in which women move forward? We've seen this, as I mentioned, the Baltic countries. Finland has a woman leader, in Slovakia. So the Czech Republic would be very interesting if they moved into that realm as well.
One last question, Bob. You know, I understand the war in Ukraine has really shifted people's perspectives, but what is the Czech people's relationship with Russia? Is this a relationship? You mentioned that the Communist Party was still strong. Are there ties with Russia that would, in fact, infuse the debate over this? Is that just not on the radar at all?
I think not to oversimplify, but there is a general wariness towards Russia now that has just intensified as they see the reports coming in and seeing the brutality playing out in Ukraine. There was, as I mentioned, under the leadership of Havel, there was a strong compulsion to join NATO. This NATO expansion took place at a time when you had Russia itself going through a lot of change, and it was, you know, tantalizingly flirting with some democratic type of institutional changes and so forth. I would say a prevailing majority at the time was like, we need to join NATO. We need to have this support. We do not want to be under that sway again. There are a number of people who still remember the 68 Warsaw Pact invasion led by the Soviets and the Russians forces and don't want to see that happen again. So I think you've seen all sorts of acting out against the Russian diplomatic facilities in Prague, certainly, and in, I believe in other parts of the Czech Republic. Miloš Zeman, again, it's interesting to note, very tight with Russian leaders, but, you know, turned against them because even for him, it was too far what has played out in Ukraine. It's just sort of the course you know, move towards annexation in that fashion really struck against the Czech chord. And we should note the Czechs had just marked their own anniversary, 30th anniversary of what was known as the Velvet Divorce. They were Czechoslovakia and then split with Slovakia in as smooth a way as you could imagine, given the roiling changes that have happened in that region in the decades since and all over the place, certainly in the Balkans, if not the Caucasus. So it's a country that, you know, is responding to the violence, the real aggression in Ukraine with a great deal of alarm. And so I do think that's made them wary, even where you still have cultural affinities with Russia. Again, when I was there in the 90s, you met a number of people who spoke fluent Russian still. I would say the pendulum has swung towards, you know, fluent English and German more often than Russian. The Russian speakers tend to be older.
Definitely an election to watch. It's kind of exciting to see what the next generation is going to look like.
It really is. I mean, the interest in elections has never been so intense, I think, these days, Sheila. But I think it's time that we talk about the audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on every Tuesday and Wednesday at CFR_org's Instagram story, Sheila. Our audience this week selected something a little bit more upbeat for a change. UN says ozone layer will fully heal by 2066. Sheila, why is that significant?
Oh, I think it's exciting. For those of us who are interested in how the world can get together on climate change, this is a positive signal that there are ways of collaborating. So just for people who are not following this very closely, the hole in the ozone layer above Antarctica, and apparently in about 43 years, will be fully recovered, which is a remarkable story. At one point, we were focused on the two chemicals, I should say, are chlorine and bromine. All of us remember.
Heat-trapping chemicals as well.
Exactly. And we all remember being told not to use aerosols anymore or refrigerants. That's the way in which the world banned the production of these chemicals in the 1987 Montreal Protocol. So it proves that you can come together and identify a causal factor and develop collaboration. And I think for human impact, it's one of the UN environmental directors said that it saves 2 million people every year from skin cancer. So it's not just our environment improving. It also has really tremendous human impact.
And it's a universal treaty. Every nation belongs to it. As one environmentalist pointed out, I heard on a radio show yesterday, when new countries emerge and are recognized either at the UN or elsewhere, one of the first things they do is join the Montreal Protocol. There can be treaties that can be of universal nature. It seems a no-brainer for this. One would hope that same sentiment prevails on other environmental fronts.
Exactly.
We'll see.
And I congratulate our listeners for pointing this out as something that we should talk about. So that's our look at the world next week, Bob. Here's some other stories to keep an eye on. World leaders and thinkers meet in Switzerland for the World Economic Forum's Davos Conference. The United States observes Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And the Australia Open begins.
And that would be the Tennis Open.
The Tennis Open. That's right.
Well, please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. We appreciate the feedback. The materials mentioned in this episode, as well as a transcript of our conversation, are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Esther Fang with senior podcast producer Gabrielle Sierra. Special thanks to Erin Gallagher for her assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons.
This is Sheila Smith saying so long.
Sheila, thanks for joining us this week. And this is Bob McMahon saying goodbye and be healthy out there.